You're listening to Upfront. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiekert, and it was 4 weeks ago today that heavy rains finally moved into Northern California, closed in on the campfire, and helped to quench a disaster that over the previous 2 weeks had killed 86 people and burned nearly 19,000 structures to the ground. All indicators from climate scientists and forest ecologists are that there are a lot more fires like that in store for us in the years to come. So we thought this would be a good time to check in on the crisis after the emergency. Thousands without homes, hundreds of tons of toxic ash standing between people who want to rebuild and the prospect of actually starting that rebuilding. We're going to start our coverage during this hour with some of the journalists who have been covering that process. Mark Albert is a reporter with North State Public Radio. They have put together an excellent daily show called After Paradise, dealing with the fire and its aftermath. Mark, thanks for coming on.
It's a pleasure. Good morning, Brian. How are you?
I'm good. So why don't we start with the basics, the almost 20,000 people who were displaced by the fire. Where are they living now?
Well, they are spread out all over the region and all over Northern California. Some people actually talking with FEMA are in Texas and elsewhere, as far away as they can get housing and start new lives or find opportunities. In addition to people losing their homes, many commercial structures were destroyed and a lot of people are, are without jobs as well. But there are many, many people in the region. Many still in shelters. FEMA brought up the first of several trailers that I was at the Rolling Hills Casino RV park up near Anderson last week, meeting with FEMA officials as the very first trailers were brought in, and they were connecting some families and putting them in existing RV parks that had vacancies. There are also plans to bring in hundreds of and create villages with hundreds of manufactured homes or essentially double wide trailers sprinkled throughout the region. This has caused some consternation and some controversy locally because the size of these trailers. It's interesting. Having sat through a lot of this, the process, recently we've sort of reached a fulcrum point where people are starting to be a little bit less welcoming and a little bit more questioning and obstinate about the impacts, at least here in the Valley.
People where, when you say the Valley, you mean the Chico area?
Yeah, this is, Chico is a relatively small town, but outside of the city of 90,000 people, you reach the edge of the city and you run into orchards. It's not necessarily like the Bay Area where one town is destroyed and you can just move people out into the surrounding areas. Chico is about three quarters the size of Berkeley. There were plans to put some 250 manufactured homes on the north edge of town, and people turned out at a council meeting where that was announced along with a debris handling facility, essentially a transfer station where FEMA and Cal OES officials said the debris, metal and concrete debris that was uncontaminated would be brought down in semi-tractor trailers and be processed at an abandoned industrial site. This is actually the Diamond Match Company, which once had a railroad going up past the fire zone for logging to make pencils and matches. It's been abandoned since the 80s, and the city has been sort of in a quandary about what to do with this site. Now, officials said they could process this waste and load it onto rail cars there and move it on out for disposal. The neighborhood got wind of this, when FEMA officials said that there'd be between 250 and 500 semi-trucks a day rolling through town, the people became pretty upset, at least by Chico standards. And you know, forgive me if I'm talking too much, but the FEMA officials have come and said again and again and again that we're here to assist the local authorities. The local authorities are going to be driving this process and making the decisions, and we're just here to help and execute what their preferences are. After this outrage, it took less than 24 hours, and FEMA and Cal OES, which said, look, this is the best site. This is the only site. We've studied this. We've rejected the other sites, and this has to happen. And, you know, we need to expedite this process because, you know, and their argument is, you know, makes a lot of sense. The longer this the longer the cleanup period lasts, the later it will be, the more delays it will be before reconstruction begins. And if people find new homes, and the town may never recover. So officials are very interested in expediting the process, but they backpedaled and actually on both. So they are not bringing 250 families, rehousing them in modular homes in North Chico. They're looking for other sites. People locally were concerned that that the site was too far from services, too far from Paradise, too far from improvement stores and other services that people would need. However, FEMA, there aren't a lot of choices. They've just announced that they are going to place 350 manufactured homes in Gridley, which is some 30 or 40 miles to the south of here.
Wow. I want to return to the question of the demolition debris. I would imagine neighbors are concerned with both the dust that would be coming off those truckloads, even if FEMA is saying that it's non-toxic, it's still dust in your lungs, as well as the diesel exhaust. I mean, 500 truckloads is a lot per day.
Yeah, it's quite a few vehicles. And, you know, we're a agricultural processing town. There's not that kind of traffic. And certainly with all the additional residents, the traffic collisions have gone up by 35%, according to the city engineer. Traffic is up by 70%. You know, I used to joke with friends that, you know, it takes 5 minutes to get across town. Now it can take, you know, half an hour or more. I know for listeners in the Bay Area, that's still sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
But people were very, very upset about this. They weren't buying any of the assurances that they received from officialdom about mitigation, either about the noise, about the diesel soot, or about dust coming off of these vehicles. And, you know, it would have to go through a residential neighborhood. It would have to go through a really small light industrial cluster to get to the site. And people just were not having it, and they unloaded on the officials, and they announced, within 24 hours that they've pulled both projects. I think there was some pressure on the landlord of the site where the manufactured homes would go, but the debris handling facility, they said that they've withdrawn their interest in that site, and it will go somewhere else. Now, there are a few, there are other sites, but the critical thing for FEMA and for Cal OES is, you know, the shorter the distance that those 250 to 500 semi-trucks have to travel to reach a rail siding where this debris can be loaded, then, you know, obviously that's less disruption and pollution and soot, and of course labor costs and other expenses.
Yeah, that's the purportedly non-toxic debris. What about the ash from homes that have burned? It's generally presumed toxic because you're talking about lead paint, asbestos, household chemicals that went up in the flames, and all of which leave residue in what's left behind.
Well, yeah, and that's correct. And there are also things that people collected. I mean, I was up there and stumbled on the remnants of someone's garage where they must have had about 15 or 20 car batteries that had all burnt up. There's mercury, there's asbestos, there's arsenic, there's, you know, the creosote. Officials are trying to keep people out of their properties. They're not letting people onto their land until and unless EPA crews in moon suits go through the area and do an initial inspection and make the area safe. I was up in the Butte Creek Canyon the other weekend with one of those teams, and mainly what they were looking for are propane tanks that might be compromised and other paint and volatile organic compounds and pressurized spray bottles, stuff like that. We're not finding a lot of, and radiological contamination from either medical devices or smoke alarms, or I'm not sure what. They were not finding any of that, but they were, I spoke to one of the supervisors, and they were taking the valves off of the propane tanks. Apparently, there's people unscrupulous enough to go into these sites and take those tanks and try to resell them or paint them or reuse them. And, you know, they can be compromised by having gone through the extreme heat. Once that is done, once that process is done, and I think they were talking about it taking until mid-June, I believe, mid-January, they were going to start what they're calling phase two, which would scrape the footprints of homes of all debris. And I honestly do not know where that is going. They're talking about shipping things out of state to a sites, to landfills that will accept that. But I'm not privy to all the machinations behind the plan.
We're speaking to Mark Alpert. He's a reporter with North State Public Radio, headquartered in Chico, California, about the first steps of the recovery from the campfire that burned the town of Paradise to the ground a little over 1 month ago. Mark Alpert, I want to talk about people who are already in precarious circumstances before the fire. You suddenly have tens of thousands of people made homeless who were housed. What happened to the people who were already homeless in your area?
Well, there's quite a few of them, and actually they've been sort of in limbo for many, many months, if not years. The city's had a robust debate on homelessness. There are quite a number of transients around town that attract a lot of attention when they occasionally create disturbances or do some petty crimes or become violent. People who are anti-homeless tend to lump those, you know, some outburst and tend to attribute that to the entire population, which makes the political debate long and drawn out. Now, there are two shelters in town, one of which houses people overnight. The other one serves lunch and has a small amount of room for some of the homeless, but there are quite a few people living in underpasses, creek beds, flood control channels, stuff like that, around the edges of town. Now, if you're discreet enough, I think that most of the good people of Chico will be happy to look the other way, but there are people who are unstable. They're having outbursts. They're, you know, breaking into vehicles, stealing mail. There's identity theft. There's package theft, and people want to attribute that to the homeless or to transients. So the situation, though, politically, there's been a push for at least 10 years to have a low barrier shelter. That would be a place for people who are inebriated or altered or on some mind-altering substance or other, or who might have an arrest warrant or a record, to have a place to go and to get in out of the rain or out of the cold, or just to cool off in a structured environment. There's been a lot of resistance to that, a feeling amongst the political majority here that that would be rewarding people who are irresponsible or rewarding bad behavior or giving handouts and enabling and encouraging people to act out. So it's been a long struggle. Now, last night, after many years, the city approved the city council will allow the city manager and his staff to negotiate with nonprofit agencies and other groups to create a low barrier shelter. They also approved a tiny house village for older homeless people who are age 55 or older. That's been something that has been pushed here locally for at least 7 or 8 years. The Conservative Council finally approved that last month, but they kind of rejected the proposed location. And without a location, there's really no project. So there's some movement on that. The Walmart came through with $1 million for both fire victims and another $1 million for pre-fire homeless. So the city is working with those nonprofits to build that low barrier shelter with some of that money. And also provide additional services. There's talk about consolidating several of the other shelters into one location. One of the things that I hear over and over again on social media are people upset that there are homeless people pushing shopping carts with their belongings around town. If they had someplace to store their items, they probably wouldn't have to be pushing all that stuff around town. But it is what it is. It's a small steps. Obviously, none of this is going to help in the immediate future because all these things take time. There is a local group that's been advocating for this tiny house village. They actually had a demonstration project 2 months ago where they built three of them in a morning with volunteer construction crews in a parking lot. It was great to see. And an inspiring event, and their idea is to have these small sort of backyard tool sheds arrayed around some central services, so bathing facilities and cooking facilities and laundry facilities, as well as some kind of wraparound care, social worker, or an on-site manager, so that the place will provide some structure and at least provide people with some security. They're unheated, they don't have electricity, but it's better than sleeping on the street.
Finally, Mark Albert, on the question of rebuilding, I understand they're still just starting to scrape the ash and make the sites that burned down safe for rebuilding. But is there a robust conversation yet about what areas are too dangerous to rebuild in? There's been a lot of criticism in press reports from outside your region that a lot of Paradise was basically a fire trap because of how close into woodlands homes had pushed.
Well, you're absolutely correct, Brian. The Paradise was built a beautiful place. If you've ever been to Lake Tahoe, very similar, towering, mature ponderosa pines, homes built into it, absolutely beautiful community. But the concern, can you make these improvements to make it safer, to make a more rational street grid, to make fewer cul-de-sacs? So you can't straighten out roads when they're following the contours of the earth. How many of these trees do you take out to reduce risk without the place becoming a barren, scorching wasteland in the summer? Do you underground the utilities to make them safer? Well, they opted not to do that. PG&E has been racing for weeks with thousands of people up there, replacing all of the electrical lines. There really was no conversation about having underground electrical lines, but who's going to pay for that? The city is funded through sales tax and property tax, and with every business burnt down, there's not going to be any sales tax, and with all of the property destroyed, there's no property tax receipts. So they're in a really tough spot. It would be great if there were if you could take a 2-year pause and sort of hash this all out and think about what would be the safest way, what would be the best way, what would be the acceptable risk in terms of rebuilding, where and what kinds of structures, what kinds of materials, can you have what kind of roofing materials, what kind of siding will make these structures safe. But all of those things add cost. And when you add cost to construction, especially in a community where people, many of them, are underinsured, not a prosperous community at all, and there's not going to be enough money for rebuilding. Even if you're fully insured with the Shortages of labor and materials, reconstruction costs soar. So it's a real problem and something that I'm sure that a lot of people will demagogue on either side. But at the end of the day, it's choices, it's priorities, and it's really unclear what will happen. What kinds of homes or what kinds of structures will be allowed, where they'll be allowed, if somebody owns a property, they own that, parcel. And if you tell them, hey, you can't build here, it's not safe, the property becomes valueless. And, does that person deserve any recompense? And who does that come from? And is it 50% of the value, 100% of the value? It's a sea of questions, Brian.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have today for that sea of questions. Mark Alpert, really appreciate you taking the time to speak to us.
It's been a pleasure, Brian. Thank you.
Mark Alpert is a reporter with North State Public Radio. They are headquartered in Chico. He's been covering the campfire and its aftermath in detail. North State Public Radio, by the way, is part of a broader public media collaboration, has created a daily half-hour program that is excellent, doing deep dives into all of the questions we raised during that interview. It's called After Paradise. You can find it on their website. My NSPR stands for My North State Public Radio .org.